So while I was in Canada, as you might expect, having formerly lived in Canada until the age of 10, I was able to traffic at some of the places I did as a young boy. I found something interesting with memory there, and I know you guys have experienced this likely in your travels. There's a memory that we have that kind of remains hidden to us. It's just totally untapped. It feels like it's entirely gone. Like you couldn't access it with any key of your intellect, of just meditating over the past. And that's how I felt when we were traveling from the airport to our first destination. We were, as it turned out, taking the passage that I so often took as a boy coming to and from church. We had quite a bit of a commute into Scarborough. Jarvis Street Baptist Church is in Scarborough there. And we had about a 45-minute commute each way. And that was if traffic was merciful, which on Sunday, there wasn't loads of people going to church, and so traffic was generally better on Sunday. But we were also really good, kind of old-fashioned Baptists, so Sunday was not the only day we were on that. We were on that road. We were also on that road Sunday night and Wednesday, and then sometimes on Friday. So we were on this road a lot, is my point. And so that would be a route that you would think I would be well rehearsed in. And remember, but I had all but forgotten it. My sisters, or I got to travel with my sister Jessica, but when they get together, they have all these memories of Canada. They came all the way into their late teenage years there, so they have just loads of these memories that they can access easily, but I have no reference point, or it's more difficult to access. And so as we were traveling on this road, it shocked me that I remembered something. We came under this kind of cool bridge, and the picture, as it was before me, reemerged in my memory bank. And I was like, "Are we on the road where we went? We're headed home. We're headed towards home from church." And she was like, "Yeah, we're on the 401 or whatever it was." And but that was completely, untapped, inaccessible, and until getting that visual stimuli. And then we went further down the road, and I was explaining to her why I remembered this particular place and why it was the only place I could remember. There was nothing else of the trip, of that road that I could remember. But sure enough, another about 5 minutes in, I said, "Oh wait, I know this bridge too. I remember seeing this bridge every time." And I'd yet forgotten that one as well. And I remembered even a sign off in the distance that I would wait for, not always for the greatest reasons. As a young boy, there was this sign that would be around the corner that sometimes had kind of dicey material up there. I was a young boy coming up to it. "Well, what's going to be on the sign today?" So I had all these memories that are kind of pouring in, some that made me filled with regret, others just curious that I thought there was nothing there. So our memory is a tricky thing. There are people whose memories are vastly superior to the rest of us. Here's a few that I found in a quick search, and feel free to question the source here. Last week, you saw me depend on a website called Demilked. This site, this week, we're depending on what sounds to me a bit more confidence-inspiring. It's called Mental Floss. But they just listed out a few people who have really unique recall abilities. So Teddy Roosevelt, anybody familiar with him? Okay, Teddy Roosevelt, he could apparently recite entire newspaper pages. So not just the articles, but the entire newspaper pages that he had read, as if they were still sitting right in front of him. He could recite it word for word, pretty incredible. And this, of course, without applying himself to the effort of that. It would be a kind of a natural recall. He was apparently also a speed reader and is reported to have read 2 or 3 books a day. Another man who I was unfamiliar with his name, but I was familiar with the movie, and you might be, that was created after him. The real life figure is named Kim Peek, and he is the figure behind the movie Rain Man. Anybody seen the movie Rain Man? I believe it's Dustin Hoffman that plays his character, and it's an award-winning film. But Kim Peek was said to have memorized every word of every book he ever read, which at first didn't really impress me because I was like, you know, I haven't read that many books. I mean, maybe he just read a book or two. And especially when I read the next line, he memorized every word of every book he had ever read, estimated at around 9,000. And at first glance, that was so unapproachable to me that my mind just said, yeah, 9,000 words in a book. This guy must have read, you know, a bunch of children's books. But what they intend to mean is 9,000 books. And then that made me want to do a Google search just to make sure. And I guess the average book, to be considered a legit fiction book, you have to have 50,000 words. And then on the bigger end of the scale, a really long book would be like 150,000 words. But this man could apparently recall every word of every book, around 9,000 books. And it's reported that it took him just 12 seconds to read one page. And each eye, this is mind-blowing, each eye could read a page independently, simultaneously. I just kind of want to watch that to see what the eyes do to accomplish that task. But apparently that's what he could do. And then one more person who's got kind of a reported incredible memory or recall that's kind of fun. Apparently Mr. T, yes, the Mr. T, gold chains, epic mohawk, that guy, he at least claimed to have a photographic memory, saying when he was young, he did not apply himself to study whatsoever. He did not need to study because he could recall just everything that he saw as if it was before him. So it's no wonder that he went around pitying the fools. Now, I don't know how your memory is. You know, my memory when I was a younger man was I remember it being excellent. I could recall things in vivid detail that surprised sort of everyone around me. Now everyone's surprised at how much I can make up that never happened. So things have changed, and some of you are in a season of life where you feel this more acutely. To remember something is a very difficult task. Even things that have just happened recently. When we come up to Psalm 9 and 10, the reason why this is hopefully a helpful introduction, when we come to Psalm 9 and 10, they're really a very intimate pair of psalms, intimate together. They're closely paired, not necessarily intimate in content, but closely paired together because they deal so much with the ideas of forgetting and so much with the ideas of remembering. And they call people, they call the people of God to remember him. Actually, it calls everyone to remember God. It even sort of describes not following God, not seeking after God, not as this ignorant thing that you just stepped into or were born into. You know, I was kind of born an atheist. But it even it makes it sound that to not remember God is to have forgotten him at the start, sort of to have ignored his existence, to not been mindful of him whatsoever. The idea of forgetting, we'll try to focus on more next week. Forgetting God. This week, we'll really try to focus on what Psalm 9 does, which is remembering God. Psalm 10 will focus heavily on what it looks like to forget God. Psalm 9, by contrast, is a more hopeful picture and more focused on what it looks like to remember God. And sort of we can siphon off of that some advice for how we are to remember God. And before we jump in here, you might say, you know, what's the value of this? You know, I forget lots of things, but I can't forget God. It's like, you know, that's something once you know or you see that you can't just forget. Like, I know God's there. I'm not going to simply forget, oh, yes, that's right, God does exist. But when the scriptures talk about forgetting, and when the scriptures talk about remembering, much more often, it seems, they're referring to ignoring and acknowledging. Not so much that recall I was referring to, of the innate ability to bring things to mind based on whatever your level of intellect or mental capacity is. We are not here trained to believe that the most godly people are going to be the people with the most amazing recall ability, but rather the most godly people are the people who are set in their way to bring God before them, to be mindful of God, to be ever mindful of God. A book that's helped me process this, I picked it up largely by accident before I took my trip, but I think it was probably the most helpful thing I could have read to prepare me for the psalm on short notice. And it's called The Practice of the Presence of God. And for those of you like me who don't, you know, I've grown in my reading capacity and desire, but I still have a hard time reading a lot of material. You can just see the thinness here, okay? This is the book for you if you're like me. And I was able to get through it in 2 days. It probably should have taken, you know, it would have taken Kim Peek 2 minutes, but that's all right. It's called The Practice of the Presence of God. And it's a very old, this is not some modern innovation, this is a very old, long-standing, celebrated work by a man familiarly known as Brother Lawrence. He's a man who decided to devote his life totally to the Lord and what that looked like in his time and in his stage back in like 1666. Was devoting himself to a monastery life, to renounce all of his possessions, and to devote himself before the Lord. And I'll just read you one thing right now. I'm going to read you some sort of tips from him later that I've found very helpful for myself, and it's much better advice than I would be able to drum up from my own experience. I am weak here in what I'm preaching today by experience. But the Lord is gracious, and this brother is going to help us out. When this man came under conviction about the greatness of God, it was when he, it's not a picture that really captured me, but it totally captured him. It seems he was just going about his day, and he saw a tree in the winter that looked like it was left for dead. There was nothing really to write home about. Obviously, no fruit. There's no leaves. It was a withered up, wintry tree. But he saw beyond that, okay, not in a vision, but via imagination. It just came to his mind that this tree that I'm seeing here as though dead, soon, in a matter of time, according to God's set decree, this tree is going to bear fruit again, this tree is going to flourish again, this tree is going to take on leaves again, and then it's going to go through this cycle, and the Lord is going to, and he was just sort of caught up in the beauty and power of God's providence. That's God managing all things, controlling all things, guiding all things towards his ends. And he was just so taken by that, by God's power and his beauty, and how important that makes God compared to everything else. That it made it easy for him to renounce everything else and pursue God. And his desire from then on was to be ever mindful of God. He set himself to literally never forget God. And not in that way that we talked about, oh, I couldn't remember that part of the trip. No, he's talking about never being not mindful of God. That's a high task. He described it this way, that he would resolve to use his utmost endeavor to live in a continual sense of his, that's God's, presence, and if possible, never to forget him more. Now let me read for you Psalm 9, and as I read it, take note of all of the mentions of forgetting, because there are plenty, of some of the persons or groups that are tasked with remembering and have the potential of forgetting God. And also, if you're able to start taking on, you'll probably see some things here that I haven't seen, but some of the ways in which the psalmist has been trained to remember God, to bring God before him. So let me read Psalm 9 for you. Hear the word of the Lord. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount all of your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before your presence. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their names forever and ever. The enemy came to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. But the Lord sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for justice, and he judges the world with righteousness. He judges the peoples with uprightness. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know your name put their trust in you. For you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who sits enthroned in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds. For he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Be gracious to me, O Lord. See my affliction from those who hate me, O you who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may recount all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion I may rejoice in your salvation. The nations have sunk in the pit that they have made. In the net that they hid, their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. The wicked are snared in the work of their own hands. The wicked shall return to Sheol, all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men. This is the word of the Lord. This language of forgetting, this specific word that shows up here three times in this psalm, two times in the next, it's absent until this section. And so there's just this kind of micro explosion of this theme in language. The theme has still been carried. It's always in the psalmist because they're always looking back. When they're giving thanks or they're expressing lament, they're looking at the past up till the present and hoping into the future. But in terms of the specific language, it's really kind of beginning to take off here. And then it gets kind of quiet shows up once in Psalm 13, once again in Psalm 31, and then has some fits and starts beyond. But it really kind of demonstrates the appropriateness of the pairing of these two psalms together. Throughout the history of the church, many have even thought these psalms actually belong not just side by side, but as one extended psalm. So if you look at the Greek version, the Septuagint of the Old Testament, there's no Psalm 10 in a word because Psalm 9 is extended throughout. And so rather than a 20-verse psalm, you have a 38-verse psalm. There's a few other reasons to think why that might be a good idea, that this is all one big psalm, even though I'm just taking on Psalm 9 as best I can today. a few other things I've picked up on. So we got the language, we have the theme. We also have, and this I haven't seen in the Hebrew as well, I just didn't have time to sit with it this week, but from what I've read, there is an acrostic pattern that kind of flows through both psalms. It's broken in places and not perfect. If you're not familiar with what an acrostic is, you haven't done one in a while. An acrostic is just, like an English version would be this: another baby cries, enduring dada. Except I flipped the D and E. I think A B C D E, but you get it. Another baby cries, dad enduring. Each of those lines starts with the next letter of the alphabet. Another baby cries, A, B, C. And so an acrostic looks like that in Hebrew as well. Each of the beginning lines will start with that with that letter of Hebrew. And so there's some continuation between Psalm 9 and 10 that people have picked up on. The other thing that strikes me, that maybe makes one of the better cases for it, is up till this point, this isn't always the case in the Psalms, but up to this point in the Psalms, once you get past those two openers, Psalm 1 and 2, all of the rest of these early Psalms, they're credited to David. David is expressly mentioned in the little subheading. You know those little things before the verse starts in your English Bible, to the choir master? And we have those over and over again, starting at 3, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Psalm 4, to the choir master with stringed instruments. Psalm 5, to the choir master for the flutes, and on and on and on. And then we have that in Psalm 9 as well, continuing the pattern, to the choir master according to Muth Laban. And I don't know what that means, but a psalm of David, but Psalm 10 has no such subscription. And the idea is that maybe initially these were intended to go together. I would say at this point, I'm guessing most of you don't really, and I don't particularly care, is it one psalm or is it two? These are great psalms. I don't really care. What I know is that these clearly go together. They go together with theme and content and language, but they present kind of two sides of the same issue. You have the experience of someone suffering. This is a common thread that we've seen in the laments that we've already seen. There's been a number of them to open the Psalms. There's the experience of the one who's suffering and afflicted, and in this case, it's particularly the one who suffers as a result of someone else or a whole group of other people forgetting God. So that's a very sort of unique setting. But what sets these two apart is that, again, Psalm 9 has this positive trusting in God, remembering God, recounting God. You probably heard that happen a couple times. Twice the language of, I will recount. It's a word that, if my Hebrew memory is treating me well, the verb shares the same idea with the noun, and I remember it only, my Hebrew is very weak, but I remember safar or safer, this word for book or scroll. And I could remember that with a little mnemonic. It's safar, to write something down if you want to remember it. Well, here we have a verbal form of that same construction. And it's the idea of, I will recount, I'm going to bring this forward. It can literally mean to count. And so it's like, I'm making a careful, I'm doing a careful exercise of memorizing, of bringing to mind, of recalling. I'm going back and thinking about what God has done for me. He says, I will recount all your wonderful deeds. And when he uses that language for wonderful deeds, it can mean, it's used later in the psalm, sometimes for simple things. Other times, it speaks of, in the prayer of Psalm 119, open my eyes that I might see wonderful things out of your words, out of your law. Or it can mean wonderful deeds, looking back. This is probably the primary thing that an Old Testament Jew would have thought of. When they're called to remember or recount God's marvelous deeds, they would think about the Red Sea crossing. So often in the Old Testament, when the people of Israel are told to remember, they are pointed back to the Red Sea and that picture of deliverance. And then that picture of deliverance is carried over all the way into the New Testament when we are brought through our own sea of sin by the grace of Jesus. I'm going to try to do three things here and do them in relatively short order. One, just to reflect on the personages, okay, the different subjects who are to exercise remembrance and who are to guard themselves against forgetting God. The second thing I want to do is look at some of the tools and try to, as best we can, to make sure those tools are fastened around our belt so that we can do this job of remembering God. And then thirdly, we will look at God described in his way of remembering things. So firstly, whose job is it to remember? According to this psalm, you can look at it at who's doing the remembering, but you can also look at it at the opposite. Who's doing the forgetting? Maybe I shouldn't say we. It's certainly true of me, and so I'm throwing that on you, but you might share in this. When I read almost anything in the Bible, but especially the Psalms, it feels very personal and intimate to me, so it's very easy to push out any of the corporate elements and just see how do I fit into the psalm. And it's easy enough to do that. The psalmist himself is saying, I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount all of your wonderful deeds. Verse 14 again, that I may recount all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion, I may rejoice in your salvation. But there's more than just the individual effect here. And it's not just you and I who can forget or remember God. It's not just you and I who are tasked with remembering or forgetting God. Did you notice how often the word nations showed up in this psalm? It was repeated, nations, nations, nations. Verse 5, you have rebuked the nations, you have made the wicked perish. And then it talks about cities coming to an end and their very memory. And then nations show up again at the end repeatedly. The nations have sunk in the pit that they've made for themselves. And it's who that forgets God who's primarily in the psalmist's mind. Verse 17, all the nations that forget God. What do I glean from that? Nations can forget God. I'm just going to keep it simple. And that was not only true of the Old Testament people. You might say that's sort of beyond our pay grade. All we can deal with is ourselves. But the point remains, whether or not we have many tools to address the forgetfulness of the nation we live in, or let alone someone else's nation and their relationship to God, let us just be mindful. It is possible and dreadful. Let me say it the other way first. It is wonderful and glorious for a nation to know God. We live in a certain unique American culture here where we feel this necessary tension of a perfect separation between church and state, and that perfect separation can't exist in the real world. You're going to have religion, whether it's a state religion or something else. Now, we try to have a happy blend of that by not having a state-enforced religion, and that is a true blessing that's come, that was birthed into the framework of the United States of America. But it is good for a nation to know God. It is good for a nation to acknowledge God. It is good for prayer to be offered, even in the halls of government. That is a good thing. It was good when there was prayer in school. That was a good thing. It is good for a nation to know God. And it is dangerous, and it is dreadful, and it is deadly when a nation forgets God. And I struggle with how to navigate these waters too, but this text reminds me what kind of natural logic always bears out, that your religious life, if it's real, is going to permeate every part of life. And there's no perfect way to cut off your political life from the rest of your life. And so while I'm blessed to be in a nation where the government does not dictate my religious affiliation, where I can worship, where I can go, I also know that there is a trapping there to say, let's have no remembrance of God in the political or governmental sphere. That is not holy, and it's not good. If that's too much for you, just drop it and go back to, what does this mean for me? I didn't flesh that out in a really nuanced way, but I'm compelled by this text that it's meaningful for a nation to remember God, and it's dreadful for them to forget. And so when people talk about whether or not they're quite on the money, saying, you know, the United States has to return, I don't know about returning to something else. I just know that America has to turn to God. So I'm not really worried about returning to some era. I would really love to see America turn to some new era, some untouched era of renewal and revival where God is honored in all spheres. So that's there. The other that's important for us to remember as a church is that there's more to life than individuals and then nations, and we are in a place and a time where the political, it's like even hard for me to talk about because it is such a large idol. It is such a big deal. It's so important in our mind. You know, have we talked about politics today? Have we talked about President Trump today and Joe Biden today? It is normative to have it fresh on the tongue. And so it's this massive thing. But much more important for us as a church is our church. If when I'm trying to apply this text, I'm thinking, what are the ways our church is at risk of forgetting God? And what are the healthy ways that we can fan into flame those exercises we are doing to remember God? Because the people of God are called to remember him. This is very prominent in the Old Testament. Moses spent a whole chapter, read it later, Deuteronomy 8. And all of Deuteronomy is this memory thing, this recounting. Moses is just recounting the whole history. Don't forget, I know you literally just went through all of this, okay? So you know it all. You know it alls, but guess what? I'm going to spend a whole, 40-chapter book just telling you all the stuff you know. And in that, in chapter 8, and in other places, but all of chapter 8, he says, remember God. Remember God. Don't forget. And they're like, yeah, we're the chosen people. We got it. How could you forget? We came through the Red Sea. But what happened repeatedly in Israel's history? They forgot God. They forgot God. And all along, they would tell you, no, we haven't forgotten God. We go to the temple. We do this thing. We do that thing. We carry out this ritual. And then the prophets come along and says, you've all forgotten God. You have all forgotten what's important. You're all running around doing this busy work, and none of it honors God. Where is his worship? Where is his praise? It permeates nothing. It's a dead ritual. And so, as important as this text is for me as an individual to be called to account daily, goodness, did I even think about the Lord before lunchtime? You know, I got busy. I had a flight going on. I had to DJ a wedding. we're preparing for where our kids are going to be, and I'm in the airport, and the day has progressed, and almost half the day is behind me, and I'm like, oh, I should try to read this. I don't have a lot of time to study, but I should read Psalm 9. And I'm like, I forgot God. This whole morning, I forgot God. He's been nowhere to me. He has been everywhere because that's who he is. He is everywhere at all times in all places. Psalm 139. God says, there is nowhere I'm not. But to me, he was absolutely gone because I had forgotten God. There is endless application for us in this. How easy is it to remember God, to be mindful of God with this thing in your pocket? How much more when it's in front of you? We can't even be mindful of the people who are in front of us, and I'm as guilty or more guilty than you here, so I'm not preaching down to you. I have this big screen phone, okay? So I'm in a constant, you know, battle between should I just smash this thing? Or should I do that as part of a sermon? And then I take a trip and I'm like, I needed my mobile boarding pass and all this other stuff. But when we're on our phones, we can't even be aware of a great wonder beside us or a great danger beside us. We could be by the most deadly snake in the world, but we could be doom-scrolling Facebook. And it would be really doom-scrolling now because there's a deadly snake right there. Or we could have a tremendous joy. Instead of just enjoying the moment and taking it into our visual data bank, we take the time to get the perfect picture of the thing. You go to pretty much any place that's beautiful, and it's like you see more cameras than anything else. And I understand that you want to get the shot in, but we can't even be present to enjoy the thing. How much more is it easy for us to forget God? How much more difficult is it for us to be mindful of the God who made the glorious things that we look at? Who made that beautiful chasm? Who made the riverway? Who makes the ocean and the waves to fall? This text urges us from someone who is practicing the presence of God. Remember God. And I do not preach as one well advanced in it. I preach as one who desires to walk in the truth of this text. Remember God. It is the easiest thing to do, and I can only think that we can attribute this to our sin nature and how far we've fallen, but it is the easiest thing to do to forget the most important person. It is the easiest thing to do to forget the most important thing. Remember God. So there are these different bodies who are called to account here, who are warned against forgetting God. We can focus on that next week, but who are urged and invited into remembering God. And it's all of us here, and it's me up here, and it's all of us together to think about and pray through and to take at least a moment today, because tomorrow this is pretty much going to be largely gone for you, and then like 2 days after for me too. I was going to ask you guys what I preached about 2 weeks ago, but then I realized it was a super unfair question because I couldn't remember what I preached 2 weeks ago until I looked at the psalm, and then I remembered how bad the sermon was. I was like, I'm not asking that question. But we are called to think about what are the ways we are at risk of forgetting God here. It's always easier to see that over the fence. You know, when Aubrey tells me about that church that's hard to call a church and had decided with no real rationality, certainly no biblical basis, that they just weren't going to do baptisms anymore. That is a church who's forgetting God. But I bet if we would not settle for those cheap looks over the fence, we could probably find some ways. I know we could find ways as individuals and thinking about our phones and thinking about, but I'm going to venture that if you and I had some little time to brainstorm with one another, we could think about ways that either in the past or in the past certainly, but even in the present, that we are at risk of forgetting God. And this might seem like a silly thing, an unlikely thing. How could the church forget God? I mean, look at this celebration of remembrance that we're about to do, this communion. It's like it would be impossible to forget God. Let us not forget the letters to the churches in Revelation we went over before. When Jesus came knocking, he did not come knocking for the community center. He did not come knocking for the nations. When he came to Laodicea, he was not going to the political offices. He was not coming to individuals one by one. He was coming to the church. Jesus Christ, the whole point of the whole church, was coming to the church to say, do you have room for one more? Because there's no Jesus here, and I know because I'm Jesus. A whole Christian church had forgotten God. It is possible for us to do the same. Let us not be so arrogant to think, well, we're so founded on the Word, and we've had such a good history of preaching, and we have those solid old hymns that remind us of older things than ourselves. And there are many ways, countless ways, for other churches, but for this church to forget God. Let us put ourselves to task and remember God. This next part's going to be real quick. Tools. There are tools that come up, that surface in the course of this letter. They're not necessarily presented as do these in every case, but they're presented as something that's being done, being employed by the psalmist as an act of remembering God, as an act of bringing his presence before himself. Two of them come in verses 1 and 2, and they're repeated later. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount the wonderful deeds. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. This is kind of an assumed or an implied tool, but the idea is to do this basic thing of thanking God, of reflecting, of recounting deeds. To do that, I don't want to push this too far, but to do that well, I think at some level we have to stop. We have to stop other things. We have to stop other thoughts. We have to stop busyness. We have to stop craziness. We have to stop anxiety. We have to center ourselves and reflect upon God. So in a sense, the first step of remembering God is to employ some means of stopping ourselves. Historically in the church, people have done this in other ways. Sometimes called the daily office. Are you familiar with the daily office? No? Okay. It's more found in liturgical churches and Anglican church. You'd probably have heard about this by now. But it's kind of a neglected practice. The idea is this. You would intentionally set times of the day that sort of gave you a forced stop to think about God. And all that was the daily office was there are three times a day where you are going to set yourself, resolve yourself to pray. You're going to pray at morning. You're going to pray in midday. I'm going to pray at evening. And what that does, you could say, well, the tool there is prayer. But actually, the tool is stopping. Because you can and we should be praying in between. The point isn't, you know, you're not praying the rest of the day, so you got to do these three times of prayer, because otherwise you'll never pray. That's not the idea. The idea is we are creatures of habit, but we are also creatures of some bad habits, and we need some methods of employment, and those hard stops can be one of those methods to bring a mindfulness of the Lord. And so a daily office, employing something that works for you. It doesn't matter if it works for your neighbor to get up before they regularly get up to pray. You know, I get up at 5 a.m. So it's not even a natural thing. It's kind of a spiritual thing. I'm bringing myself out of a normal process to begin with the Lord. But if that doesn't work for you, then it's not going to matter. You're just going to be miserable. So you find something that works. But the first encouragement would be build some stops into your schedule, into your life. I am not doing this well. I have some morning stops, and I have an evening stop. And then I have, like you guys do, some meal stops. But the rest of my stops are usually spontaneous. And they usually are wonderful times of prayer that follow horrible times of neglect. And so the encouragement here would be for myself and you to employ some stops for ourselves. Probably the most useful one for me, again, if it helps, great. If it doesn't, let it go. But one of the most useful ones for me, one visiting professor at Gordon-Conwell, he recommended doing a quarterly thing. So every, you know, however it works out in your day, every 3 to 4 hours, that's how he would break up his day. And the first one would be thanking the Lord for sustaining him through the night. Thank you for sustaining him through the night. And then he would pray for the next hunk of the day. Instead of praying for, you know, just the big out there scary things and the, you know, the diagnosis and that stuff, he would pray for this next quarter of the day, for these next 3 hours. Lord, be with me. And if there is a particular anxiety that's going to happen, I got a meeting coming in the next, you pray for that one. And if there's any confession that's required. So each of these times would ideally have praise for God, they would have petition, and they would have some element of confession. Because inevitably, you'll find, as you grow in your prayer life, you will find yourself to be a worse sinner than you had thought before. You will find yourself not necessarily growing in sin, but growing in awareness of sin. And you will realize how much bigger of a sinner you are than you thought. The more you pray, the more you see it. And so, if that works for you, I encourage you to employ some type of, whether it's twice a day or three times a day or quarterly, put some stops in there. The other one, I don't know exactly how to employ, but I'll just say it. When the psalmist recalls things, whether he's singing to recall or because he's recalling he's singing, that's not clear to me. But he sings. I could play a number of kind of old classics like I did at the wedding yesterday, and if I played those for you, it would probably recall some memories. spiritual songs have the same capacity. And they have the ability to sort of jog us out of a spiritual stupor or a spiritual funk. Sometimes when I'm just feeling nasty or neglectful, or I'm just languishing, I'll just, she's very courteous and quick to respond, I'll just ask Alexa, "Alexa, play my worship playlist." And that's a playlist that I've been curating over time, just one song at a time. It started just with one Kirk Franklin song, and we built from there. But make a playlist, especially if you access streaming services or something. Make a playlist and then employ that. And the singing will help you remember who you are and who God is. There's multiple times where he says in verse 2, "I will sing praise to your name." And verse 11, he actually urges others. It's not just some weird thing that he does. It's like, "I'm just David, the singing, dancing guy. I know you're different." And he says, "You sing." Verse 11, "Sing praises to the Lord who sits enthroned. And this will help you be mindful of the Lord." Find a way to bring song into your life. There's some people who are like, "I don't really like to sing." But I'm pretty sure it's not true that anyone has no enjoyment of music. Just like, life would be better if there was never a song. Like, there is something that's wrong with that heart. Okay? So the tools you have so far: stop, sing. And the third one is share. David doesn't just share this in confession with the Lord, but and this happens many times in the Psalms, where he breaks beyond his own conversation, and all of a sudden it's like he's speaking to someone else. It's like he's praying in church. And like here, where he's urging them to sing. He even says in verse 11, "Tell among the people his deeds." So it's not just recounting in yourself. There is something precious that happens when we share the goodness of the Lord and when we share the struggles of life with another believer. If your Christianity is all you and Jesus, I'm not going to waste time rebuking you for that, even though it's wrong, because I pity you in it. If all of your Christian experience is you and Jesus, try home groups this year, because it is so much better to live your life with Christ with other Christians than it is to live alone. So stop, sing, and share. This will help us remember God. We are prone to forgetting God. I have confessed some of the ways I forget God. The Lord was very merciful to me in showing me many of the ways I've forgotten him and some of the ways I used to remember him. And there was a sweetness in that, even though there was kind of hardship in seeing that. Maybe I'll close with this encouragement from Brother Lawrence. I had four or so pages I wanted to read from him, but I read from my book a little bit longer here. So let me encourage you with just two little things he wrote. So he said this. The book is just a conglomerate of different conversations that were had between Brother Lawrence and another Christian, or a set of other Christians, and some were direct conversations, other letters. Here was a part of one of the letters, talking about God and the importance of worshiping him and being mindful of him. "He requires," saying, "God requires no great matters of us." This should encourage and comfort you if you're like, I am a world away from the psalmist in remembering God. Me too. Let this comfort you. "He requires no great matters of us. A little remembrance of him from time to time, a little adoration, sometimes to pray for his grace, sometimes to offer him your sufferings, and sometimes to return him thanks for the favors he has given you and still gives you in the midst of your troubles, and to console yourself with him the oftenest you can. Lift up your heart to him. Sometimes, even at your meals, and when you are in company, The least little remembrance will always be acceptable to him. You need not cry very loud. Sometimes that happens. He is nearer to us than we are aware of. It is not necessary for being with God to be always at church. You should be at church. I'm glad you are. But take this as a comfort. It's probably something me and some of my old-timey Baptist cohorts could have used hearing. It is not necessary for being with God to be always at church. We may make an oratory of our heart, wherein to retire from time to time, to converse with him in meekness, humility, and love. Everyone is capable of such familiar conversation with God, some more, some less. He knows what we can do. Let us begin then. And he closes kind of summing this, and maybe I'll leave it here, and we'll move to our act of remembrance together. Accustom yourself then, by degrees thus, to worship him. Okay, accustom yourself by degree. He says in another spot, responding to another woman, he says, you're running way ahead of the grace of the Father. No one becomes holy like that. Let God work in your heart. You start putting those stops, start singing more, but you and I are not going to be Brother Lawrence tomorrow. So appreciate that this is going to take time to be ever more mindful of the Lord and to stop forgetting him. Accustom yourself then by degrees thus to worship him, to beg his grace, to offer him your heart from time to time, in the midst of your business, even every moment if you can. Do not always scrupulously confine yourself to certain rules or particular forms of devotion, but act with a general confidence in God, with love and humility. You may, and then he just said, you may be assured of my prayers for you, and likewise. So let us then, by degree, remember our God more. He is worthy of us being in constant remembrance of him. We know that as a technical fact. I know that God is worthy of me never forgetting him. I also know that on this side of heaven, there will be times where I forget him. By the mercy of God, take what this text says elsewhere. I'm not going to read it now, but God remembers. For all of our forgetfulness, Scripture beckons this claim. And you can only take it by faith. You especially need to grab hold of it by faith when you are in hardship. God remembers. You forget. And he knows you forget. And he knows I forget. He remembers. And in this small way, we will remember him together, the God who does not forget.